Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The Baseball Literature and Culture Conference has been held here at MTSU since 2006. This year's event is scheduled for this Friday, March the 26th, in the James Union Building. This is the conference that started at Indiana State University back in 1995, and it's a chance for scholars to get together and discuss one of their favorite subjects and one that lends itself to a lot of fictional and non-fictional treatments, baseball. This year, the Department of English is pleased to welcome the first Hall of Famer ever to address the luncheon session. Ferguson Jenkins compiled a 284 and 226 career record between 1965 and 1983 with the Phillies, the Cubs, and the Rangers. He won at least 20 games in each of six consecutive seasons he pitched with the Cubbies from 66 to 72, chalking up 24 victories and the Cy Young Award in 1971. And we're pleased to be talking with Fergie today from his home in Anthem, Arizona. Fergie, thank you for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Nice to come on with you.
Hey, you did your Fergie and Friends celebrity baseball game in Arizona on the 17th on St. Patrick's Day. How did it go?
Oh, I think it went extremely well. We had a great day. The weather was fine. The game started about 7:30 after all the introductions. And I just think that the fans enjoyed watching some of the older players that suited up in a Cub uniform. We also had guys from the Royals, guys from the Giants, Phillies, and four or five Hall of Famers that people really look forward to seeing. We had a meet and greet on the field. Bob Feller, Gaylord Perry, Billy Williams, Raleigh Fingers, and myself were the Hall of Famers. And we had a lot of all-stars from, you know, Jody Davis, Keith Moreland, Bobby Dernier, Willie Wilson. Really had a mix of guys that played in different eras. Randy Honey was a catcher out there, too. So I think it really worked well. The fans enjoyed rubbing shoulders with the fans, players on the field. And the game went on, and then we played a seven-inning ball game, and there wasn't any injuries, and everybody left.
Especially in a game of retired players. It's always good to say no injuries, right?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of the players are older now. I think the oldest player on the field last night was Bob Feller, 91. And then came, you know, Billy Williams is 72, and Gaylord Perry is 70. I'm 67. So there was some age on the field. We still love to put the uniform on, act like little kids again when we were in our 20s. But I just think that the fans enjoy seeing some of the older players, getting autographs, and, you know, I think everyone that plays the game, when you retire, you kind of find out, you have individuals that think you're the best player to ever play. So there's a lot of fans coming up to you, and they kind of congratulate you, you had a great career, or we've seen you play in the 60s or the 70s, and we enjoyed your career, and that's fun to hear.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about it is, everybody enjoyed themselves in the game, and it went pretty smooth.
Now, even though you played for two other teams, you went into the Hall of Fame, essentially, as a Cub. You live there in Arizona where the Cubs train. You are essentially, people think of you as a Cub, and essentially you feel like a Cub, don't you? More so than in any other team.
Seasons with them. When I first came to the ball club with Adolfo Phillips and John Hernstein, my roommate was Byron Brown. He was there last night. I finished my career, you know, basically with the Cubs, and I roomed with Ernie Banks for 3 years during that session. And I just love to go to Wrigley Field, and playing day baseball was a big important part of my life. Didn't play under the lights. The lights came in 88, but I had already since retired. I retired in 83. But it was a fun 10 years. We didn't win any championships, but we got awful close.
Oh, yes, especially in 69. What is your take on how the Cubs are going to fare this season? You've looked at them in spring training. What do you think their chances are?
They've got a pretty good pitching staff. Right now, Bob Lilly is hurt. He's going to probably come back maybe in June. He had a shoulder injury and had surgery. But they've got some decent pitching. I think Carlos is a great pitcher, along with Dempster, and we've got a young fellow named Wells, and so many other Marshall, other young players that are filling that bullpen role. But I think they're going to be a pretty strong contender in that Central Division, along with the Cardinals and Milwaukee. So they've got their work cut out. The spring training's not over. There's going to be some jobs won, some jobs lost. But when spring training is over, I think the Cubs will report to Chicago healthy, and I'm hoping they have a good season.
I think they've got the second best record in spring training right now behind the Braves, and of course it's, you know, one loss records in spring training don't mean anything, but to what extent, you know, as a former player and as an observer, to what extent is spring training a good indication of what your prospects are for the regular season and what kind of talent you got? How much does it tell you?
Well, spring training is a very important part of what baseball is all about, getting in good shape. You're getting to the point where your mind is thinking totally about good baseball, fundamental baseball, and essentially, you know, getting to the point where everybody gels together. You have to have chemistry on a ball club, on and off the field. If you don't have that, it's going to be a miserable season for you. So I think that that's what they're working at right now, to get the starting rotation in good shape, along with the bullpen, offense and defense. And understand, you know, Lou Piniella's got a tough job of juggling the lineup, trying to find the right mix so that these individuals know their role on a daily basis and play the games. There's 162 ball games over a six-month period, on and off the road. So it takes a while for guys to get really into the mix, because a lot of guys play better at home or they play better on the road. So there's always that home and away record that you'd like to have these individuals understand that you should always play good for the home crowd. And when you're on the road, there's a lot of Cub fans, but still you hope that you have an outstanding road record that always helps you.
What is it about Cub fans that makes them just so uniquely passionate? It's like no other fan group with respect to other teams that I've seen. Only the Red Sox diehard fans, I think, can really parallel it in the American League. How do you account for that unique level of passion they have for the Cubbies?
Well, the Cubs haven't won since I think it's 1906, something like that. I mean, it's been over 100 years.
The World Series, you mean?
They were in last place so long. When I joined the ball club, they were in last place in this early 60s, mid-60s. And they kind of climbed their way out of the doldrums and getting into first division. It's not, I think, an important situation that you look forward to come into the ballpark to lose all the time. So you always look forward to coming to the ballpark with a winning attitude, an understanding that you put that uniform on today and you got a 95% chance to win. If you don't have that thinking on a constant basis, you're going to lose. So when I joined the ball club and Leo DeRocher was the manager, he tried to get our mindset that we came to the park to win, not to lose, not to play, you know, good baseball. We came to play winning baseball. And I think that's been a tradition over the last, 20, 25 years. And the fans understand that. And the fans want to see us win. And I think we have that following.
You mentioned the Cardinals as a division rival. And as you know, Mark McGwire is joining them as a hitting coach this season. And back in January, you wrote in an open letter to the Associated Press that McGwire needs to apologize to all the pitchers he faced. McGwire admitted earlier this year that he has used performance-enhancing drugs as a player, which everybody suspected after his congressional non-testimony in 2006. What did you mean by, elaborate on that a little, that he needs to apologize to the pitchers he faced?
Well, I mentioned probably several things. Apologize to two great organizations, the Oakland A's and the St. Louis Cardinals. By far, he needs to let them know that what he did, he knew it was illegal, and he took them regardless. Then, all the pitchers he gave up home runs. He could have finished a lot of baseball players' careers because of the fact that hitting a home run early in the game or late in the game or doing what he did to hit well over, you know, 500 home runs. I just think that the apology he gave on the Costa show was kind of short. Wasn't really enough. Even though that Costa thought that, he kind of showed emotion enough to let people know that what he did, he knew was dishonest, and he wanted forgiveness. But to let the other players he played against, or even with, that he is truly, you know, sorry for his emotions, for what he did. I mean, every time you make a mistake, especially in baseball, it gets magnified in any kind of sport because the news media grabs it, throws it out there. And I just think that his apology didn't really have enough content to it.
Yeah, you mentioned some things that hardly ever get discussed when the issue of steroids comes up, and that is that when people cheat and take performance-enhancing drugs and succeed as a result of that, then you're affecting the careers of the people against whom you play adversely in a way that affects their lives and their livelihoods and that isn't really fair to them.
Well, yeah, I just think that, you know, steroids have always been illegal in sports, but baseball didn't have a bylaw yet that you couldn't take steroids and perform on a daily basis in baseball. And the Olympics was illegal, football is illegal, basketball. Baseball just had some shortcomings, and I think they still have shortcomings. Right now, people are thinking that, you know, a lot of athletes are taking designer drugs or HGH, and it's not detected yet, but all the players are tested, I mean, monthly, so to try to clean up the game, because at one time there was a heavy cloud over baseball, a black mark that was really disturbing from Commissioner Bud Selig to the Player Association manager, Donald Fehr. I just don't think they did enough. And right now they're putting out different testaments about if you get caught 50 games, second time 100, third time you're out of baseball. But I just think that why get caught that first time? Play the game fair. That's what the game was all about, going out there and playing it to your best of your ability because you've got a God-given gift to play the game and play it well. You don't need chemicals in your system to make you play well.
Willie Mays and Hank Aaron told Bob Costas that they never took anything during their playing days, and it never even occurred to them to do so. In your playing days, did players juice up with amphetamines or other kinds of drugs?
Oh, sure. That was always something that hit the headlines about somebody doing this, somebody doing that. They got a prescription from a doctor and used it. I just think that it was apparent from time to time. But not the way it was in the late 80s and 90s because of the fact that all of a sudden steroids had jumped up. And that was the drug to take. It made you bigger and stronger. You could perform longer. You hit the ball better. You threw the ball better. And I just think that the concept of putting these chemicals in your system enhanced you putting bigger numbers up, which meant you made more money, made yourself a millionaire. And I think it just changed the game.
What do you think should happen to all the records that have been amassed during the steroid era? Should the players who were mentioned in the Mitchell report have their records thrown out, or how do you think it should be handled?
Well, the Mitchell report kind of exposed a lot of individuals that did things wrong. I'm not sure a lot of players and probably the commissioners I've mentioned higher-ranking people that own ball clubs want to put asterisks around a lot of things that happen. But as of right now, it just hasn't happened. The records are still standing. As it's happened now, guys are still in the game. Guys are holding positions that I think are pretty strong with ball clubs, hitting coaches, pitching coaches, managers. And it's just something that I think the game needs to investigate a little more. And if they think that they need to, I think, ban certain numbers, it'll happen. But as of right now, it's still under suspicion, and they're just guessing on what they should do because baseball is a sport that people enjoy numbers. And as a player, I knew that as a hitter, if you went 3 for 10, you're a great ball player. So those other 7 at-bats, I mean, the game was to the point where, you know, you're always on a losing end, but if you could survive with 3 out of 10, that meant you're a 300 hitter. And as a pitcher, you know, you win half a dozen games every month or so. I mean, that you put big numbers up. And if you could win 20 games in a season, like a lot of the guys did when I played, Gibson, you know, I think Maury Wills, a base dealer. I just think that you did so many good things. People remember those, and they don't remember the bad things.
McGuire's major claim to fame is, of course, the 1998 home run chase with Sammy Sosa. And the New York Times reported last year that Sammy tested positive in 2003 for performance-enhancing drugs. And there have been rumors swirling around him all along. Is there anything Sammy can or should do, do you think, to clarify the record one way or another?
Well, a lot of these players are now getting exposed to what happened 10 years ago. And I just think that the press is playing it up pretty big. And I, myself as a player, I'm not sure what's going to happen. There was like 103 players failed the drug test in 2004 or 5 in spring training, and the Mitchell report exposed so many guys. It's really going to come to a head, I think, if ownership wants to clean the game up even more, because a lot of these players, that's only 4 or 5 years ago that these guys failed this test. They could be still in the game. Who knows? So the owners are going to have to do some soul searching. And if these players are still active, how are they performing? Are they performing well enough that they still, you know, can play well, and they still have a job with the ball club? So I think it's still under investigation.
As a Hall of Famer, do you think that players who have tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs should be banned from the Hall?
Well, as of right now, they're not getting any votes. You know, you look at McGuire. Sosa's on the list. I'm trying to think of some of the other fellas that had their name involved in some of these drug incidents. As of right now, they're not getting any votes, or they're getting some, but not enough to get into the Hall of Fame. Palmeiro is one. In a year or so, Giambi's going to retire. I just think that it's going to be up to the reporters that cast the ballots, because they're on the Hall of Fame list, and it takes 5 years after you retire to get put on the ballot, and then it's judgment by some of these reporters. And there's, as I said, there's well over 500 reporters that cast ballots, so the public will find out like everyone else.
Well, let's move on to a happier topic now. The Baseball Literature and Culture Conference, which is slated for the James Union Building on March the 26th here at MTSU, and you're going to be the luncheon speaker. You've written 3 books about your career. What do you like to read about baseball? What to you is a good baseball book?
Well, you know, I think players like to tell the public where they came from, how they got started in the game, and what it took to be a good ball player, what it took on a daily basis to go out there and win to the point where they're consistent. It takes a while to learn how to win correctly with your fellow teammates, and as one individual, as a pitcher, you don't win alone. As a first baseman, you don't win alone. As a center fielder, you don't win alone. So it takes a combination of 25 individuals that whole season, 9 guys at a time on the field to try to win a ball game. So there's a learning aspect to that result. And then travel, learning how to eat correctly, how to travel, to get to the point where when you put that uniform on, you're telling yourself, for your family and the fans, for the organization, you're going to give what you can to win a ball game. If it's 90%, 60%, 110%, whatever. But you are exposed every day when you go out there to perform well, to try to win.
Do you have a favorite baseball book, a book that about baseball that you enjoyed reading more than any others?
Well, there's different books. The Dodgers have Inside the Dugout, The Glory Days. Jesus, so many. You know, there's been so many movies on TV on baseball. I just think that the enjoyment I had writing my first book was, and I titled it through just thinking about it, like nobody else. Nobody had won 20 games 6 years in a row, and it was like 40 years. I think the last guy to do it was Warren Spahn. I think Robin Roberts did it too, in the 40s and 50s. I did it in the 60s and 70s. So I just think that it took a while to accomplish that record. So I just threw that title out, and it wasn't saying that I had a big head or anything. I just, when I threw the title on it, the context of the book said all the players that played with me, like guys like Lon Santo, Ernie Banks, Billy Williams, Kessinger, Beckett, Hundley, so many guys, Spangler, Gene Oliver, these individuals all had a part of making Ferguson Jenkins look good because of the fact that I had to defend my part of it by pitching, and then the defense and offense scored me runs and played really good baseball for me to win ball games.
It's nice to hear a guy give credit to his former teammates. When you read a book about baseball or you see a movie about baseball, do you think how close do they get to the real thing? I mean, to what extent do the fiction writers and Hollywood get it right when they try to tell a baseball story?
Well, it's pretty close. There've been some good movies out there. Pound the Drum Slowly was a movie I seen quite a few years ago.
Yeah, Bang the Drum Slowly.
It was good. I mean, with I think it was De Niro.
Yeah.
But I just think that they try to depict what these athletes were all about. You know, showing them on the road, off the road, playing the games in certain stadiums. They really can't get it to the point where they get into the hitter or the pitcher's mind, which is something. I mean, there's so much intensity in those games. It's not really depicted, I think, well enough, but you try to get as close as you can because some individuals are on the end of their career, some are just starting as rookies, and there's a lot of pressure involved. And the involvement of all that pressure, how do they cope? How do they cope day to day? So it takes a strong individual to really put that that hard work to light and what you learned prior from the minor leagues, now you're in the big leagues. And it takes a while to stay consistent, to tell coaches and managers, hey, I belong here, I work hard enough, I'm going to produce, put those numbers up, and I belong, and I want to stay as long as I can. I was fortunate enough to pitch 18 years in the big leagues. There's guys that pitch longer. Nolan Ryan, I think, pitched like 24 years in the big league. So it takes a lot of intestinal fortitude, and you got to stay healthy.
Yeah. Well, hockey still rules in your native Canada, as we saw during the Olympics. But how would you assess the popularity of baseball in Canada these days?
Well, there's been so many players over the last couple of decades that have come out of Canada. There's so many provinces. They've come from Quebec, Ontario, British Columbia, Manitoba. When you look at it, baseball is all over the spectrum. It's an international sport. There's fellows now from Holland, Germany, Netherlands, Japan, Korea. So it's not just sport for the players in the United States. It's all over. And I'm pretty proud to know that a lot of good Canadians are now in a baseball uniform and making a good livelihood.
Are there several minor league teams in Canada?
You know, it's not minor league teams that you see. Some are independent ball clubs, but you play a sandlot organization. There's there's teams in, as I said, in BC or in Alberta, Saskatchewan, a lot in Ontario, Quebec, and it's a summer league. It starts basically in May. And it ends in September. And a lot of times you're only playing on the weekends, so you might play 35, 40 games Some of these cities now have travel teams that play, so some of the players get to play maybe a little more. But in the 50s and 60s, when I played, you played either a Saturday or a Sunday, and it was run by an organization, a service club called possibly the Legion or Optimus, Kiwanis, JCs, that type of organization.
Do the colleges have baseball teams in Canada?
Well, I didn't get that question.
Do the colleges have baseball teams in Canada?
There's a couple of colleges out west in BC that have baseball programs. I've not known of any schools in Ontario like Ryerson, University of Toronto, Western Ontario, that have baseball programs. So they really haven't gotten into the baseball. They play football and basketball and hockey, but the baseball program really just hasn't been developed yet.
As a kid growing up in Canada, what attracted you to baseball over any other sport?
Well, my father played a little baseball in some of the leagues. He played for the Chatham Black All-Stars, which was a Negro team, and he played with the Black Panthers, another team that was out of Windsor and Chatham. I just think that Chatham being pretty close to Detroit, about 60 miles away, my dad would take me to see ball games at Tiger Stadium. And just seeing the players play, I kind of got interested in it at the age of 15, 16, and it just kept developing, and I learned how to pitch at a young age. And, within 2 years, when I graduated high school, 18, out of almost a tech school, that I got a chance to sign with the Philadelphia Phillies.
You have, before we let you go, Fergie, you have a charitable organization, the Fergie Jenkins Foundation. Let's talk about that a little bit. For which causes do you raise money?
Well, we started the organization almost 12 years ago in St. Catharines, Ontario, where it's based. We started with the Red Cross, and we've added cancer research. My mother died of cancer. My mother was also blind, so we added the Canadian Institute for the Blind, the CNIB. We now have juvenile diabetes. We have different cancers like lymphoma and other different cancers that we support. Boys and Girls Clubs, Make-A-Wish, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Here in Arizona, there's so many that we've tried to be involved in. But it's been a great run so far. I mean, when we get letters from different organizations would ask us to come to their city and put on an evening for them, selling memorabilia or having an auction to make money for their organization, it really makes you feel good because of the fact that we are trying to help their charity. We have, on a daily basis, maybe 7 or 8 students from different colleges in Canada and just on the other side of the border in Buffalo that will get hours for their scholarships. And they're into sports management or into advertising. These individuals come and get their hours working for our foundation, both male and female. And it's a lot of fun to see these youngsters work hard to try to accomplish that.
Fergie, you're a credit to the game, and it was, even though I'm a Braves fan, it was fun watching you play when I was growing up as a kid. And anybody who can survive Leo DeRocher has my total admiration.
Yeah, I've been Leo for 8 years, let me tell you. He was a tough manager, but he was fair. I think he got the best out of me. And when I look back, there was a lot of things he said to the ball club that really would hit home to what he was trying to get across to some of the young players. Because when I joined the ball club in 66, I was like 23 years old, and a lot of other guys were young, and we had to learn how to win and learn how to win on a consistent basis. And he was one of those leaders.
He was a no BS kind of guy, wasn't he?
He was, no nonsense. I had Billy Martin for 2 years in Texas, too, so he was also no nonsense. So I had some of the tough managers in the game.
Ferguson Jenkins is going to be the luncheon speaker at the Baseball Literature and Culture Conference presented by the MTSU Department of English Friday, March the 26th in the James Union Building. Fergie, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I really enjoyed it.
It was a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to seeing everyone when I come there.
All right, we'll see you there. This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can catch the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.